Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer here at the Institute, and I'd like to start off by welcoming everyone to the seventh in our series of project reports. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to everyone Navy Chaplain Fellow Charlotte Hunter, who will be talking today about religious issues in U.S. military operations. Now, most recently, Dr. Hunter served as an advisor to the Chief of Navy Chaplain's Office here in Washington in the area of professional development for the entire U.S. Navy Chaplain Corps. In addition to her recent assignment here in the city, she's completed a total of three tours of duty with the Marines. She served as the chaplain aboard the USS Emery S. Land, and has also taught mid-career and senior chaplains at the Navy Chaplain School in Newport, Rhode Island. She's been an active duty chaplain since 1988 and is a representative of the First Church of Christ Scientist. Dr. Hunter also holds a PhD in humanities from Salva Regina University. So we're absolutely delighted to have someone with Dr. Hunter's expertise and background here to talk about such a timely issue. Now, as some of you likely know, the Institute has devoted a great deal of attention to issues of religious significance, most importantly in our program on religion and peacemaking, as well as in a number of our other programs. So I encourage all of you, if you've not already done so, to please check out our website. And also, please check out the table out in front of the room. We've got a lot of special reports and other USIP publications. There are also many that can be downloaded from our website. So please check that out for further information. I'll let everybody know that this event will be recorded and available at least within a few days on our website. And at this point in time, I'd like to thank a couple of individuals who've made this event possible, two research assistants here at the Institute, one, Mandy Laso, who's not able to be with us, and Lauren De Amore, who is not present in the room, is still outside out front. So thanks to them. And at this point in time, I'd like to ask everyone to turn off their cell phones and Blackberries. Please, I urge you, because if they're not turned off, there'll be interference with the microphone. So we will find out who you are if you do not turn off your phone. So please do that. So with that, I think I'll turn the floor over to Charlotte. She'll speak for something about half an hour, 40 minutes, something like that. And then we'll open up the floor for questions and answers. Okay? So please.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming here today to be a part of my presentation. I appreciate the presence of you all and the effort that it took for many of you to get here. I'd also like to take just a few moments to thank Lynn for her support as she has helped me with this project, and also John Christ, who has also been an enormous help. I couldn't have done any of this without them. It's a delight to see Cheryl back again, and I'm so pleased that you could be here. I also want to take just a moment to acknowledge the other fellows, many of whom are here today. I cannot tell you how much I have appreciated this year the opportunity to be associated with such intelligent and committed men and women. It has been a wonderful privilege. I want to start off my presentation by sharing with you two very short stories. The first story goes like this. An Army Lieutenant Colonel who was assigned to the 433rd Civil Affairs Battalion in Iraq in March 2003 had a contract put out on his life by a local sheikh. Now, in that country, of course, such a threat was not to be taken lightly. But the colonel, rather than taking extra safeguards for his personal safety, or to use the Navy term, battening down the hatches, he arranged to meet with the sheikh. And during their conversation, by means of an interpreter, the colonel shared texts of the Quran that he believed demonstrated that a death threat was not in accordance with Islam. He was able to do this because he had spent considerable amounts of his own time studying Islam and reading the Quran. And after a good bit of give and take on the subject during this meeting, the sheikh left and announced to all of his followers the next day that no one was to fight the Americans. Rather, they were to be given a chance to show their good faith. And although this colonel was threatened similarly by different people at least six more times during his 16 months in Iraq, and despite being wounded in a roadside ambush, he continued to steadfastly show his respect for the religion and culture of those Iraqis with whom he came into contact. Frequently, when he went into villages to talk with local leaders, he removed his hand weapon and handed it to another soldier, allowing himself to be seen as both vulnerable and trusting as he interacted with, ultimately, over 3,500 local leaders and imams and religious leaders, in most cases using his demonstration of trust and knowledge of the Quran to gain cooperation in his battalion's mission. He left Iraq in mid-2004, the recipient of two Bronze Stars for valor, and leaving behind a large number of local Iraqi leaders with a favorable impression of this American and his efforts to bridge gaps of communication and understanding. The second story is a little different, and it takes place in Afghanistan. In that country, the two dead bodies of Taliban fighters had lain on a hill in southern Afghanistan for more than 24 hours, and they were beginning to decompose. Four U.S. soldiers set them afire. According to Army spokespersons, this was done for hygienic reasons and nothing more. But although that may have been the reason why the burnings occurred, what happened afterwards was two of these soldiers got in a truck outfitted with a loudspeaker system and proceeded to broadcast taunts about the burning to suspected Taliban in a nearby village. They were saying things like, you Taliban, you are all cowardly dogs. You're too scared to come and retrieve these bodies, and so you let us burn them. Now, unfortunately for those soldiers, or perhaps fortunately, that incident was captured on film, and it was broadcast. And clerics across Afghanistan protested loudly, calling the burning a desecration, because cremation is not condoned in Islam, and declared that this was a situation that was worse than what had happened at Abu Ghraib. President Karzai likewise condemned the incident, also using the word desecration, and demanded an inquiry. The U.S. military stopped all its psychological operations in Afghanistan until all unit members received training on Islamic and Afghani customs regarding treatment of the dead. In Washington, D.C., the U.S. State Department condemned the incident and instructed all U.S. embassies to assure foreign governments that abuse of remains was not reflective of American values. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, who was visiting Lithuania at the time, ordered military leaders to expedite their investigations into the incident. In the end, the two enlisted personnel who had used the loudspeakers to taunt the villagers were reprimanded and sent to nonjudicial punishment. The two officers who ordered the body burning were reprimanded for showing a lack of cultural and religious understanding. The reputation of the U.S. military, to put it mildly, was not enhanced by this incident. These incidents and others inspired me in the project that I chose to research, which has to do with how we train U.S. military personnel with regard to cultural issues as a whole, but religious issues specifically. It is a fact that military training for combat operations revolves around the cultivation of basic battle skills. These include things as simple as how to follow orders and as complex as how to shoot and whom to shoot, how to maneuver safely in tight situations, and lots of other things. These also include learning more subtle skills such as managing one's fear. It is tough training. It requires many, many, many hours and a lot of repetition. It prepares a soldier or a Marine for a time when that person must make an instant decision about who will live and who will die. understanding of and respect for religious differences and similarities is not a topic that one finds in the curriculum of this sort of training. Yet again and again, religion is a force that intrudes upon military operations for good and for ill. When military leaders have taken the time, usually their own time, to become acquainted with religious issues pertinent to the area of responsibility in which they serve, the results have often been positive. They have often also too little been noted because peace, frankly, does not sell papers or create shock when it's seen on television. When military leaders have failed to take religion into account during their planning or their operations, one can barely see for the cow manure that goes flying off the fans of the fan blades of public opinion abroad and here at home. For the past several years, there's been a very lively and interesting conversation that's gone on in military intellectual circles, a conversation about culture and cultural training. This talk of culture finds its cause in the increasing awareness and equally lively conversation among military leaders and strategists that the U.S. military went into Iraq and Afghanistan with virtually no expertise or training in counterinsurgency operations. They then found themselves facing insurgents in both countries, yet failed to switch gears and tactics for several years. Counterinsurgency stratagems, frankly, have never been popular with the majority of formally trained military leaders and strategists who much prefer fighting conventional wars, like the wars of the past. This focus on fighting conventionally is a holdover from the two world wars and from the Persian Gulf War. And it persists despite the fact that the U.S. military has spent much of the 20th and certainly all of the 21st century fighting unconventionally or asymmetrically. In operations that used to be called, when I first came into the military, MUTWA, military operations other than war, but which are now often referred to as fourth generation warfare, in which there are no nation states, or rather there aren't necessarily two nation states fighting one another, but perhaps one nation state or many fighting against people who are not aligned with any state at all. The advocates within the military for counterinsurgency training have cited cultural training as an integral part of the whole. For the U.S. military to succeed in cutting off insurgents from their primary support, which is usually the local population, the military must understand the local population, their mores, their means of livelihood, their aspirations, in short, their culture. And the level of talk in this regard went up quite a few decibels last fall with the publication in a journal called Military Review of an article by a British Brigadier General, Aylwin Jones, who more or less tactfully pointed out that the American troops, because of their lack of cultural awareness, needlessly alienated many Iraqis and thus hampered the military mission. U.S. Army personnel, he wrote, were too quick to consider killing or capturing all insurgents as the key and perhaps only means of dealing with the insurgency, failing to grasp that combatant operations in the midst of a people struggling to rebuild economically and politically might frustrate any hearts and minds campaign. And the Army, he said, well, unquestionably, the ultimate warfighting machine suffered from its failure to cultivate within its ranks the cultural knowledge and savvy necessary to win another form of war, one in which victory is measured by whom and to what end Iraqis choose to ally themselves in forming the future of their nation. A number of American military leaders, notably Army Lieutenant General David Petraeus and Marine Lieutenant General James Mattis, agreed with much of what Brigadier General Aylwin Jones had to say. These men had already come to much the same realization and had for some time been urging the acceleration and improvement of cultural training for all military members. But this cultural training that they have pushed and which they have succeeded in introducing into a lot of military schools while admirable and certainly an improvement over what had existed before, which was virtually nothing, has, in my opinion, missed an important mark because it has virtually ignored religion or relegated it to a minor factor in the cultural whole. The military does not consider or study religion as a strategic factor in its actual or potential operations, leaving this to who? Well, people like us, who are doing research in think tanks or in academia. The neglect of religion in the military is not, at first glance, entirely surprising. While widely acknowledged as a primary force in individual lives, religion has frequently been viewed as too hot a potato for mere American mortals to handle, particularly when religious contentiousness might be an issue. Because we have been bolstered here in America by a tradition of separation of the religious and the secular, Americans spent much of the 20th century pretty comfortably convinced that religion was a private issue, seldom made public and seldom the source of serious conflict, other than occasional spats about the Pledge of Allegiance, school vouchers, school prayer, and possibly abortion. And even after the tragedies of September 11th, the idea that religious differences might form the basis for terrorist or insurgent violence, much less ongoing sectarian-based warfare, I believe still strikes many Americans as unfathomable, certainly as unreasonable, and usually something that ought to be confined to rare and isolated events or the insanity of small groups, whether these are Branch Davidians who are holed up in a compound in Waco or whether these are members of Al-Qaeda hiding in Pakistan. Within the military training establishments, neglect of religion lies both in the common view of religion as a private issue as well as the fearful possibility that substantive training on this subject might result in negative public scrutiny. Incidents from the military's past haunt the training leaders of today who remember the furors that were raised over religious issues when, for example, in the early 1970s, the U.S. Naval Academy was sued and publicly ridiculed for requiring chapel attendance of all its midshipmen in the name of religious education. And again in the 1980s, when the United States Army was sued for maintaining what was alleged to be an illegal federally funded chaplaincy. Furthermore, among military leaders, religion is widely dismissed as a source of conflict. Military leaders are much more apt to relegate religion to a motivational back burner. Conflict's heart, they insist, lies in politics or economic oppression or some other combination of factors. It is these things that create conflict, not religion. Religion is just something that comes in handy to provide fuel for a particular fire, so it hardly deserves scarce training and education dollars, much less expertise on the part of military leaders, planners, and strategists. Yet within our own ranks, much less in areas abroad, we have seen religion act as a powerfully divisive force, one that has hampered the ability of at least some of our military units to function well, and this is always a serious matter that military leaders have to take into account. When the 101st Airborne Division's 326th Engineer Battalion was preparing to enter Kuwait from its camp, preparing to enter Iraq from its camp in Kuwait, one member of the unit, Sergeant Hassan Akbar, threw four grenades into the tents of his fellow soldiers, killing two and injuring 14. Immediately after being apprehended, Sergeant Akbar claimed that he had done this because, based on the comments of other members of his unit, he was afraid that soldiers were going into Iraq to kill fellow Muslims at will and to rape Muslim women, and that he also feared for his own safety as a Muslim in the American Army. During subsequent legal proceedings, The brigade's equal opportunity advisor admitted that several other Muslim soldiers in the brigade had complained about being treated unfairly, but she was unable to say how these complaints had been addressed or if they were. The unit was delayed in its mission, hampered by the tragic loss of 15 of its members, and in April 2005, Sergeant Akbar was sentenced to death by a military court. Additionally, in the last 2 years, the U.S. Air Force Academy has found itself embroiled in multiple investigations and at least one lawsuit over alleged religious discrimination, favoritism, and proselytizing on the part of military and civilian administrators and faculty, as well as cadets, all of whom justified their actions as part of a dedication to educating spiritually grounded officers. One flag-level officer at the academy was quietly removed from the promotions list for his next star, most probably because remarks that he had made were seen as being part of the problem. The reputation of the academy was undoubtedly damaged, and an extensive amount of training there is now devoted to education about religious diversity and respect for same, which is wonderful education. But it is taking up a great deal of time that the academy would undoubtedly have enjoyed spending on other issues. Now, I am quite willing to admit that the soul of humanity, those religious tenets and practices that are dear to men and women, that sustain their hearts, motivate their actions, and comprise their very identity in this world and in the next, constitutes tricky ground to negotiate in training and education. In the world of military operations and civilian aid provision, wrestling with such depths can well seem untenable. One factor in the reluctance to consider education and religion that deserves attention is the doubt that exists in many military minds that knowledge of religion and religious practice and differences will aid in mission accomplishment. For these men and women who infinitely prefer to wrestle with easily quantifiable and handleable issues, addressing religion and religious issues seems akin to being asked to work through the intricacies of string theory. It has no clearly established or understood parameters, and so it is not predictable. And because it is not predictable, it is seen as being too hard to deal with and too time-consuming. Thus, the best and easiest course to follow is either to ignore it or to hope for the best. Some military and civilian scholars, however, as well as a significant number of military personnel actively engaged in the current conflicts, attest to the important role of religion in the non-state, asymmetric, fourth-generation warfare that Iraq and Afghanistan have thrust upon the U.S. military. And why do these men believe that formalized comparative religious education of military personnel is important? Because they understand that religion and spirituality are major driving forces in the lives of individuals in this country and abroad, and that neglecting or avoiding substantive discussion and education about religion's power creates a weakness that can be and has been exploited by our enemies. In the course of researching my project, I looked for instances in which religious education and religious sensitivity were deliberately inserted into military training and strategizing for a particular mission. And I want to share with you one instance that I know of, one that formed a controversial part of one of the most controversial wars in which our military services have fought. And this happened in Vietnam. In 1964, Marine General Victor Krulak took command of the Fleet Marine Force Pacific, in which assignment he had full responsibility for the training and readiness of all Marines in the Pacific region, including all Marines headed for Vietnam. Following President Kennedy's 1962 direction that the United States fighting forces should focus on counterinsurgent operations, and inspired by the British experience in Malaya, as well as his own understanding and grasp of the U.S. Marines' successful counterinsurgent stratagems in other parts of the world, General Krulak instituted counterinsurgency training for all Marines heading for Vietnam. This training, he believed, would not only assist Marines in effectively engaging the enemy, but would do much to win the loyalty and trust of the Vietnamese people, a factor he considered critical to any success in that region. During their training, Marines explored guerrilla fighting. They also explored peaceful interacting with local populations, working with indigenous military, and role-playing throughout all this training to provide the maximum possible realism. They were prepared to interact with local people with a measure of cultural awareness and sympathy, training that was specifically and methodically included. But this cultural emphasis, as General Krulak himself wrote in an article several years later, was not just a happy accident or simply an idea that came to him out of the blue. It became a part of this Marine training at the insistence of his command chaplain, Captain John Craven of the U.S. Navy Chaplain Corps. Upon his arrival at General Krulak's staff in August of 1964, Chaplain Craven immediately began investigating the training curricula for Marines, and he noted that nothing was included on the religion and customs of the Vietnamese people. He made some inquiries with the Army Headquarters Pacific, and he found that the Army was teaching virtually nothing about the cultural foundations of Vietnam to its soldiers. But Craven was told that a study had been done sometime earlier by an Army chaplain, a study that insisted that there was a need to understand the religions of indigenous peoples in those countries in which Army troops would operate. It was, Craven concluded, a comprehensive and persuasive study that had fallen on deaf ears at higher training echelons. He took the study back to General Krulak, as well as some area studies that were then being produced by the U.S. State Department that addressed religious and cultural issues. And he, Chaplain Craven and his staff, began preparing a series of lectures on the religions of Southeast Asia that would be provided to Marines and the chaplains serving with them, training supplemented by role-playing exercises in which chaplains, dressed as and pretending to be indigenous religious leaders, immediately began to interact positively and negatively with Marines throughout their training. At one point, for example, one of the training scenarios had these faux religious leaders persuade all the villagers to lie down in front of the Marines' tanks, refusing to move until certain demands were met, and forcing these Marine leaders in training to consider options other than simply rolling over the local population. A chaplain on Chaplain Craven's staff, a chaplain by the name of Mole, was tasked to produce a series of lectures on religions and customs of Southeast Asia, lectures that would possess scholarly depth and practical import. He was sent first here to Washington, D.C., to George Washington and American universities to gather as much information as possible, and he was then sent to Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, where he conducted what amounted to extensive ethnographic research in each country, focusing particularly on religion and its influence. The fruits of his labors were not long in coming. When, for example, an artillery shell inadvertently damaged a Vietnamese Buddhist temple, Chaplain Mole was dispatched by General Krulak to assuage the feelings of the monks and the locals in that area, and he quickly succeeded in establishing trust and easing tensions. And the lectures that he prepared were delivered to the troops in Vietnam. They were prepared by the chaplains, delivered to chaplains in Marine units, and these chaplains then taught Marines what they felt, what the General Krulak felt they needed to know about the religious and social customs of the Vietnamese. As this training developed, as it was delivered, and as it began to prove successful in helping Marines interact with local populations, two things became clear. First, the training needed to expand to include examination not just of what Marines were seeing among the local population in terms of religion and other customs, but how the Marines themselves were reacting to these differences. What did it mean to them that they were interacting with men and women who were very different from them in how they believed, in how they worshipped, and in how they worked? Second, the Marines had to be taught not simply how to fight and win the war for territory, but how to win the trust and loyalty of the people. Case studies that were developed that examined actual situations in which Marines had interacted with local populations, interactions that had at times succeeded and other times had failed, and everybody studied them. One of the chaplains on General Krulak's staff produced the first edition of what would become known as the Unit Leader's Personal Response Handbook. And these handbooks address their contents toward platoon leaders and second lieutenants. And while chaplains continued to deliver lessons on indigenous religions, the burden of responsibility for all this religious and cultural training eventually shifted toward the combatant leaders until eventually each unit, each Marine unit in Vietnam, had a personal response officer supplemented by work done by civil affairs personnel. So as they fought the Viet Cong, the Marines worked with the men and women of several villages that had been periodically terrorized by fighting between American and Viet Cong forces. The Marines helped the villagers dig wells, reestablish schools, build clinics, rebuild marketplaces, and establish security perimeters, slowly winning trust and support. And during the next couple of years, while the villages did see occasional incursions by the Viet Cong, the area remained largely stable and quiet, a success that General Krulak firmly believed could be spread throughout the what was then called South Vietnam. He was not a man who was ever shy about his opinions, and he believed that in this effort, in the effort that he had instituted, lay the hope of the battle against the Viet Cong. It was not a belief that was shared by General Westmoreland, who was in charge of all the U.S. forces in Vietnam, nor was it a belief shared by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. While both of these men said that what Krulak had put together seemed very effective, U.S. forces lacked the time in which to implement it on a major scale. Krulak responded by saying that the United States didn't have the time not to take this approach. It would be proved true, he said, that if the people were for us, we would triumph in the end, and if they were against us, the war would bleed us dry and we would be defeated. Now, although considerable interest in the Marines' personal response handbook and training program was evinced by the many low-level inquiries that General Krulak's staff received from the Army General Staff members were uniformly hostile to the Marine concentration on pacification efforts, what was called pacification efforts. General Westmoreland said that this was work that, if it was going to be done, had to be done by Vietnam forces, not American forces, because he simply did not have enough troops to put in every single Vietnamese village. In fact, he did have enough troops, but he chose to use them in other ways. Other Army generals remarked that the Marines obviously did not know how to fight on land, particularly against guerrillas. And one Army general said that the Marines were involved in counterinsurgency of the deliberate, mild kind that contributed virtually nothing to the war effort. General Krulak, however, maintained that the Army's war of attrition was simply playing Hanoi's game. The battlefield he recognized, upon which an insurgency is waged, and the objective of an insurgency lay in the minds of the local population. In short, the usual tactical objectives, hills, bridges, rivers, meant little, and the usual battlefield statistics, enemies killed and wounded, meant even less. Interaction with the local people, interaction based on religious and culturally astute understanding and trust, formed the crux of counterinsurgency, a fact that seems sadly to have remained unclear to the more conventionally minded U.S. Army. By late 1967, the Marines were forced to bow to the will of the senior Army commander, and the efforts which had proved so successful were abandoned in favor of massive firepower to inflict large numbers of casualties on the enemy, but which also resulted in huge civilian casualties and social disruption. The slow, careful cultivation of relationships based on religious and cultural respect was superseded by conventional large-scale battles that allowed the Viet Cong to paint the Americans as neo-colonialists bent only on exploiting the country and paint the Vietnamese government as mere puppets. The ignorance of the commitment of the Vietnamese communists was one part of the American loss in that area. Another was the adoption of a poor military strategy that favored tradition over innovation. Yet another, however, was the refusal by Army leaders to address, respect, and work within Vietnam's religious and cultural reality. The extent to which this played a role in America's failure there cannot be overestimated. Now, while the judgments of the overall success of this singular Marine effort may be open to interpretation, I think it is fair to say that much of the religious and cultural training that occurred might not have evolved as quickly and effectively as it did had General Krulak not been persuaded both by Chaplain Craven and by his own expertise in counterinsurgency techniques that the Marines in Southeast Asia would never be successful in counterinsurgency operations unless they possessed a respect for and understanding of the religion and culture of the people among whom they would live and fight. The unit leader's personal response handbook did what many modern-day advocates of cultural training recommend. It took a practical approach to counterinsurgency operations, provided cross-cultural education that would assist Marines in their interactions with indigenous peoples, and it exemplified the Marine commitment to adaptability, initiative, and improvisation. It is my belief that a comparative study of religions, as well as the psychosocial dynamics of religious faith, constitutes important cross-cultural study. I don't think that this sort of study could be termed anything other than cross-cultural. But the study of religion advances the cross-cultural elements differently than do anthropology, history, literature, or sociology, because the study of religion addresses heartfelt convictions and issues of identity that eschew easy compromise and simple pluralisms. Religion examines whole worlds. It examines intersecting worlds, and it examines worlds within worlds. And it encompasses so many things as it does that exploration. It encompasses politics, philosophy, art, and even science. It is a fact, as I said earlier, that military training is tough, and it has to create tough men and women who can do a very dirty job. It has to make these men and women capable of going into battle and facing all of its challenges. But as one scholar, John Schindler, has said in his discussion about military intelligence and counterterrorism, toughness is no substitute for coherent strategy. The Pentagon needs more religiously and culturally savvy human intelligence. In current and future struggles against religious extremists, the Pentagon requires military members possessed of expertise about religion that contributes to military situational awareness, to an understanding of faith-based motivations that can assist in defusing violence before it begins, as in stability and support operations, or defeating warriors of violent faith. Without the education to achieve such understanding, no military force can judge a religion or its values. Thus, no military force can make rational strategic predictions about religion's impact on the mission. Today's military men and women must, at every level of responsibility, be prepared to engage in cross-cultural conflict resolution. And this demand requires the ability to comprehend the diversity of humanity's religious traditions while seeking common ground for communications that generate peace. It is no longer sufficient for military strategists and planners to define mission success in terms of enemy dead, territory secured, or violence suppressed. New frameworks of mission success must be generated, including both a utilitarian knowledge of religion and other cultural factors, coupled with a principled commitment to honor that diversity in foreign nations and within American military ranks. As the U.S. military continues to seek coalitions with other nations in the fights that undoubtedly lie ahead, religious issues will arise. A coalition may consist of a great variety of religions, each of which may have special requirements that ought to be considered when planning coalition operations, including religious holidays, festivals, taboos, and all sorts of other things. I'm reminded of one particular incident that occurred during the Korean War. The Greek contingent of the UN coalition required live lambs that would be slaughtered for an important religious ritual. But lambs were in short supply in Korea. But the U.S. Army quartermaster was determined to meet the need of the Greek contingent, and so they went into high gear and they found lambs and they delivered them to the Greek soldiers. But what they did not understand was that for this ritual, these lambs all had to be female. They hadn't thought to check that before they were delivered. The Greeks thus felt that their religious needs had been addressed carelessly, while the Americans felt unappreciated for the prodigious effort that they had gone to just to find lambs of any kind. In the end, after a lot of talk, everybody agreed to remain friends and continue on. In future conflicts, however, in which Americans join up with all sorts of believers of all sorts of faiths, such incidents are likely to increase. And who wants a military mission to be hampered even a little by religious misunderstandings among friends? It's bad enough when it happens among enemies. As I noted earlier, considerable discussion is ongoing in military and civilian circles about the best means of countering the asymmetric threats that currently face the United States and other nations. And too often these discussions, even among those individuals whose experiences in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Balkans should have taught them better, center around counter threats of accentuating the speed, the force, the weaponry, the battle space dominance of the U.S. and other Western military forces, factors that have been standard elements of conventional military training for decades. The need now is to look to the unconventional, the improbable, the enduring, the powerful. Attempts to divorce religion from strategic plans for engagement, containment, stabilization, support, and nation building based on the Western love of pragmatic reason over religious complexity and relationships may further compound current or future conflicts. It is time to look at religion as a bona fide factor in all military strategic planning and as a requirement, not an elective, in education and training for military leaders and planners. Opponents of the United States military will always seek out our weak points and exploit our vulnerabilities. And when it comes to willingness to understand and engage with the power of religion, members of the U.S. military are very vulnerable. The U.S. military must adapt its stratagems, its training, and its tactics to fit a world in which religious faith, the foundation of culture, constitutes a force that can outlast and, metaphorically at least, outgun the most sophisticated weapon and the largest number of troops. And this adaptation needs to be given serious consideration in every echelon of the United States military. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Sean. Charlotte, for a very interesting and informative talk.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll open the floor to questions and answers, and I'm going to take a liberty of my position to ask the first two questions, the first of which has two parts. And I'm quite curious, after hearing your talk, what other militaries do in the area of cultural and religious training. I imagine that there are some differences here. I'm also curious which militaries do a better job of this kind of training, and if you happen to have any thoughts as to why. So the first question has to do with the sort of a little, if you can give us a little comparative study. And the second, I'm wondering if you think that we should be putting the bulk of our public diplomacy efforts in training with the military, because this is the group of folks that really has the most direct contact with other people. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on those two questions, and then we'll open it up to the rest of the audience.
Okay. As to what other militaries are currently doing in terms of religious and cultural training, some of the militaries around the world are doing actually a very good job in terms of cultural training. The military in Great Britain, in the Netherlands, to a certain degree in Australia, and my understanding is also to a certain degree in India, they have devoted a fair amount of training time and dollars to teaching their soldiers, their Marines, what is needed to be culturally astute when they are dealing with local populations, how to interact peacefully, and yet also how to counter cultural manipulations made by the enemy. As for religious education, that is much more difficult to pin down in these other militaries. There is some that goes on, but I don't know that there is a great deal. Mm-hmm. It tends to be more broadly based cultural training. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, your second question?
Oh, I'm wondering about public diplomacy, if you think that we should be putting more efforts into training of the military in religious and cultural
for public
issues.
Policy purposes?
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about this huge effort, public diplomacy effort run by Karen Hughes. I'm not sure if she's still running it, but that there's been concern as to whether or not how successful it's been. And mm-hmm. I just wonder if you think we should really be putting the bulk of our efforts here in training of the military so that they can, because they're in the sense on the front lines of dealing with other cultures.
Well, you bring up an issue mm-hmm. that is receiving some mm-hmm. attention, although not a great mm-hmm. deal. Mm-hmm. I've spent the last 40 minutes stating that I think that religious education, mm-hmm. in terms of the psychosocial dynamics of religion, needs to be included in military education because it can be a plus in terms of military strategy mm-hmm. And planning. But as to whether or not the military ought to be trained so that it can interact effectively in terms of winning friends, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. well, that's a little more difficult because the military is trained to go out and do and mm-hmm. conduct combat. That mm-hmm. is its primary purpose. Mm-hmm. There has been some conversation, particularly since our military has been involved in stability and support operations, mm-hmm. police operations, for the last several years, that maybe there needs to be another force created mm-hmm. that actually does more of this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A former USIP fellow wrote a book on that, Ron Perito. You know, he wrote a book called Where is the Lone Ranger When You Need Him, which mm-hmm. talks about creating a separate force. Mm-hmm. There have been other people, both here at the Institute and mm-hmm. folks at senior military service schools, that have also put forth ideas that maybe what we need is another branch of the military mm-hmm. that specifically goes out mm-hmm. and handles operations after combat is over, so that the fighting force is able to pull back mm-hmm. and that warriors are not forced to do public relations mm-hmm. jobs. But to be honest, in terms of my thrust of training, mm-hmm. I think this applies to both the combatant forces and to any other force that might be created. They both need to have this mm-hmm. kind of understanding, religious and cultural understanding.
Okay. Thank you. So we'll open it up to the audience, and can you please identify yourself before you speak and try and keep your questions and comments brief. We've got quite a few hands. Actually, I think to keep things simple, let's start on this side of the table, and we'll take perhaps three questions sort of so we can get everybody in. So we'll start with you and then move on to Dana and Avi.
Hi.
Okay.
Thanks for your lecture, though. I'm Benazir. I'm from India, and I work for the Osgood Center. Mm. Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned that, like, armies in Britain and Netherlands and India and are trained to, like, address certain religious issues in their military operations, but being an Indian, I know for sure that in spite of all these military training and stuff, there are unspeakable horrors committed by Indian Army, especially in Kashmir. Mm-hmm. Kashmir, like, I have a Kashmiri friend who tells me all these, like, she's a personal, like, victim of all these things and stuff. And I just feel that it's all because of, how should I put it? It's like their psyche is molded that you, when you commit such horrors to civilians, you would not be punished, mm-hmm. punished much. You will, at the max, you can be court-martialed or something, but you're not going to be killed. But at the same time, when the same atrocities are committed to fellow soldiers, you know for sure that you're going to be sentenced to death or any serious crimes. As you just mentioned that one Muslim soldier was sentenced to death because he killed his fellow soldiers. But such punishments are not enforced when it comes to the matter of civilians. Mm. So this has a great impact on the psyche of the soldiers, because these are tough people mm-hmm. who are molded to respond to mm-hmm. terror rather than training. So what do you think about that? Okay. Mm. Okay. So don't you think, like, you should have a code that would, like, I don't know, I would just like that would punish the soldiers if they deviate from certain actions, even if it concerns with the civilians and the local population. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's just as a safety mm-hmm. measure. I do not mean to say that mm-hmm. every other poor soldier must be punished for his action, because that's not possible, but at least.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Let's move on to
Dana Ayer, fellow here at USIP. Charlie, I congratulate you, and I think a really rich paper, and I want to highlight a couple of points and ask a kind of a difficult question.
Oh, great!
On the one hand, because I'm going to ask you, what are you going to do about it, right?
Yeah.
On the one hand, I mean, you point out a very nice, nuanced awareness of the relationship between how militaries think about war and what they think is important, mm-hmm. and in particular, you point out the kind of there's this ironic relationship of a very conservative military right now that is thinking basically as a bunch of military Marxists in very economically determinist ways about dynamics. And so I think that's a very important relationship. The other thing I think that you point out that's really important is that, I mean, you have to deal with religion at a level that it goes beyond the Greeks need ewes, whereas the Gurkhas need goats on Dishwali. I mean, that kind of very superficial level. You really have to think about the nature of religious experience, the quality of belief, all those kinds of things to really get at not just at kind of the tactical gloss, but the true operational and strategic importance of religion. Now, the American military is by kind of military sociology, by polling, is increasingly conservative and increasingly kind of in a Protestant in very kind of evangelical and fundamentalist ways, in which, and I mean, as I'm a lapsed Episcopalian, right? So doubt is the center of the religious experience. How do you foster that kind of awareness of that deep religion, that deep awareness of religion, when that really get people to have to ask very basic questions about their own religious experience?
Well, the first is...
We have so many questions okay. here, but Avi, and then we'll turn to Charlotte.
All right.
I'm Avi Sagi-Schultz, a fellow at USAP. Thank you, Charlotte, for your presentation. I enjoyed it very much, and the paper, too. And I certainly for providing diversity and cultural education and religious education, and even, you know, expanding the linguistic skills of, you know, of people on the one hand. On the other hand, I would like to pose what might be seen as a provocative question. I see here a dissonance, a gap that I'm not sure that can be resolved. And I can tell it, unfortunately, from my own experience as a mental health officer in the Israeli military. You deal here with two conflicting missions. One mission, and you mention it, is the mission of being a combat soldier, and you have a role, a very clear role. On the other hand, you want to expect the combat soldier to be humanitarian, to be understanding. This is very difficult to bridge. We have an experience, clear-cut experience, and I'm sure that the U.S. military has this experience as well from a mental health perspective, that once the military has to do it to deal with civilians, you have a substantial increase in mental health reactions, combat reactions, combat fatigue. And it's very difficult to deal with it because it's an inherent, you know, internal conflict between the assuming that, you know, that the soldiers are, you know, good citizens and, you know, have been exposed, you know, to good value system. There is a major contradiction between the value system about the fact that you don't fight, you know, with civilians. You fight, you know, it's army against army. But here you deal with army dealing with civilians, okay? And in my understanding, from a psychological point of view, it's a very difficult, if possible at all, to resolve. So my question is, which is a bit provocative, because I really for, you know, educating, you know, soldiers to be, you know, to have, you know, diversified views, cultural. This is excellent. This is wonderful. But isn't it too naive to expect that the military can deal with it at all? Even with all this education, there is a tension here between, you know, the need to approach civilians adequately, but can we really, and you pointed to it, that maybe, you know, people who were sent, you know, to do certain mission
prepared to engage in cross-cultural
other tasks. And I just want to know what's your reflection about it, because I really am a little bit, you know, doubtful mm-hmm. about the capacity of a military to deal with it. You know, the military has a role, a mission, unfortunate, you know, missions, but, you know, once, you know, you have these soldiers over there, isn't it too much to expect for them, you know, to use a different, you know, a different line of approach? I doubt if this, you know, could be obtained.
I have to say that I share your concern and, to a certain degree, your doubts about whether or not we can expect Marines and soldiers to go into an area, engage in hostile firefight with insurgents, let's say, for an example, insurgents, and then instantly turn around and pat little babies on the head and start to repair schools. But while I think that this is a tremendously difficult task, one that occasionally, too often for my taste, military members don't manage quite as well as I would like them to do, and certainly there are psychological consequences as a result after combat is over. What choice do we have? What choice do we have if we are going to send our militaries to go and take care of these situations? We could have pursued other means of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. That was not something that we were really allowed to pursue. The commander-in-chief said, you will do this. So the military went and did it and continues to do it, and is doing it to the very best of its ability, given the training that it's been offered. This is not a new situation. I'm not trying to blame this current administration for putting us in a particularly untenable situation. It's happened in the years past. Certainly Vietnam was an example of that. Since the military is going to be tasked to do these things, it must be trained in the best way possible. And while its members must be trained to be warriors, to be riflemen in the Marine Corps, they say every Marine a rifleman, every single one. At the same time, I think there is room for introducing aspects of humanity that allow soldiers and Marines to change gears as best they can. Will they do it perfectly? No, they will not. But allow them, give them tools that will allow them to change gears more effectively. I do not think, for example, that we have given enough educational time to these sorts of issues, whether it is the psychological demands of what it takes to address these dichotomous roles. It certainly, in terms of religion and culture, we have not previously done a great deal for that. The experience in Vietnam was one of the rare occasions when that was deliberately done. But when you give people more tools, when you give them more education, I think that you make them more able to perhaps switch gears than they would be without the education at all. So unless the United States government, for example, is willing to come up with that separate force that will go in after combat operations are over, then I say we have got to train the American fighting forces as best we can to deal with people, because we are probably not going to have the luxury of fighting against other nation states in conventional wars again. Mm-hmm. It probably isn't going to happen. It's going to be more of what we have seen. And it is tough, very tough. And to move to your question, Dana, because I think the two are in many ways tied together, yes, addressing religion and religious issues is a very difficult thing because it does touch upon such scary areas within each of us. But that's, again, that's not an excuse for not trying.
Well, no, and the question is how, though?
One way to do that is to put it in the safety of a classroom. Classrooms are wonderful arenas in which to explore all kinds of ideas and to battle things out between students where they can have discussions and arguments about what is right and what is wrong, what I perceive to be true and what you perceive to be true, and how do we reconcile these things. The military never has enough training dollars. Never. I worked in the military training establishment for 8 years, and they never, ever gave us enough money to do what we needed to do. We need to keep insisting on more, more and more and more training dollars, and more real emphasis put on these issues to make them another powerful tool in the backpack of every military member. And to get to your examples, and I really appreciate your bringing them up, one of the ways in which I hope to expand one of the ways in which I am expanding my project is to talk about certain areas of the world in which military forces have engaged religious groups and populations. Sometimes it has worked very well, sometimes it has worked very badly. Two of the examples that I'm using are the incident at the Golden Temple in Amritsar back in 1984. It was a disaster. It was such a disaster that not only was the temple itself badly damaged and many innocent worshippers killed, but it resulted in the assassination of the Prime Minister of India, the direct result of a military's poor response to religious issues. And another incident I want to look at is the Indian Army's reaction to the takeover of the mosque in Hazratbal in Kashmir. Another incident which went a little better. It was not entirely good, but it went a little better. looking at those, looking at case studies like this, while I cannot go and certainly resolve the issues that occur in armies around the world, but by creating a better education in this country based on actual case studies in which militaries or paramilitary groups have had to address religion and religious issues and worshipers and their needs, my hope is that we can have a more intelligent military that perhaps will cope better the next time something like this comes up. Mm-hmm. That's my hope.
Great, thank you. Let's move on around the table. Let's hear from two of you and from this lady here, and we'll take the three of you, and then you can respond.
Okay.
Please tell us your name.
Mary Moen, and I work with the Bosnia Music Book. I just wanted to ask this question. Who was the Israeli, the Israeli who went into the mosque that started the Second Intifada? Wasn't that what started the Second Intifada?
Baruch Goldstein?
No,
Goldstein.
It was Sharon. I couldn't remember who it was, and that started.
Oh, you mean up at? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to know. I couldn't remember right now whether it was Sharon or who it was, but that did start the Second Intifada, did it not? Because of his disrespect for that, or?
Well, I think you could get some arguments from some people, but yes, there are some who would say that his visit, Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount was one of the things that started that off.
Well, there is a real problem there with respect. Many of the Arabs don't respect the Israel itself. How do you solve that problem?
It is such a big problem that, frankly, it is beyond the scope of my project.
Yeah.
But I leave it to the other fellow here.
Okay, let's hear from both of you, and then we'll have you respond. Okay,
Dr. Hunter, your work is impressive, not only impressive, visionary and transformational in nature. It's ahead of its time. I'm Dr. Irene Sapi, University of Maryland. I have 19 years in the military, from enlisted to officer. I've been in combat before. What you're speaking about is exactly the truth. I work in intelligence and also in civil affairs, and in both areas I've found very increasing importance of understanding culture and religion. Those two areas are so symmetrical in nature that it's very important for us to work with. One of the areas that we have done is to always tell the area operation commander is civil affairs, special functions teams, where we work with culture and religion, and we study culture and religion. As an intel officer and as a civil affairs officer, I have to know not only the friendly forces, but also the enemy forces. I have to also know what is the religion, the language, the culture, what is the history, background. And with all those assets and information and intelligence and also in culture and religion, I have to tell my commander-in-chief what is happening in the situation. And when they do that, and the commander makes decisions in the battlefield, sometimes the priority listing is not in special functions as culture or religion. Mm-hmm. So what you're speaking about is changing, and I have jot down something that's very important, is revamping the educational system and training. We do training for ethical, reason, and moral standards in the Army. It will be good to do something cultural and religion, especially in the area of operations that we're combating, for non-combatant and combatant operations. So we are talking about peace, education as a vehicle of transformation for changing the mindset of military operations. And that is something that is ahead of its time and is something that can be worked not only with some of the areas that you place on curriculum change, but also policy making on priority from the chief of staff all the way through. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a priority. And so I applaud your work and I honor it.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. My name is Suzanne, I'm from Iraq, and I'm like my attorney in the Oslo Center. I like a very important point. As a Kurd from Iraq, and seeing this issue, I could feel it that there must be a religious and cultural understanding between the civilians and the U.S. Marines. It's important. As you know that for Muslims, that religion is something a great part of their lives. It's kind of different with Christian people. So we do consider a lot about our religion. So and you know that in Iraq there are kind of like conservative people. That I can see that it happens, and I hear many stories due to like lack of understanding, not understanding religion or cultures. So, I know that in case of, like for example, in case of Abu Ghraib, I mean, this is against humanity and any kind of culture. But for us, as Muslims, there was something. I mean, it has a great impact. I can't say on the Muslims at that time. I mean, till that time, people were kind of trust on Americans. But when this happened, people start losing trust on American race. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I can say it's very important. I mean, now there must be understanding, there must be cooperation to rebuild Iraq. I mean, people need to. I mean, we have been going through like lots of sufferings under Saddam Hussein. So now it's time to get. I mean, to relax for us. So that's why, and to get that, we have to now. I mean, I can see a great issue. There must be understanding between the civilians and the U.S. Marines. And I was just wondering, as an Iraqi, what has been done about that? I mean, about religion or culture training. I mean, till now, I mean, I just want to know, did they do anything about that? Has been any training about this?
Okay, let me address your question, because I believe it ties into what you have to say as well. There has been, over the last couple of years, some training that has been offered to all military personnel who have been deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq. It's usually done at a large training center. Most of the time they've been Army training centers or the Marine training centers. And according to people who have either written about their experiences or with whom I've talked, who've gone through the experiences, the quality of the training has been uneven, to put it mildly. There have been times when a particular instructor has been very interested in cultural issues, religious issues, and so on, and has done a very good job.
That's right.
Within a very limited amount of time, I might add, given to that person to give that training, an hour. Mm-hmm. There have been other times when there have been instructors who were not at all interested in it because they had so much else that they had to convey, and they might have spent 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it has varied, in my opinion, too much. It has not been, although there is a standardized curriculum, it has been very difficult to ensure that the right amount of time has been spent and that the people who are teaching it are themselves educated and interested. And it helps to be both educated and interested in what you're teaching. So there have been some people who've told me that the extent of the cultural training that they got before they went to Iraq or Afghanistan consisted of not showing the bottoms of your feet to people or, not doing something disrespectful within a mosque, and that was it. That's not sufficient to deal intelligently or compassionately with a people who have, as you said, already been suffering a lot and have had to face not only foreign troops in their midst and the overthrow of their leader, but have also had to deal with an insurgency. So we need to improve that training. We need to make it more systematic. We need to make sure, I think, we need to make sure that it is taught throughout all levels of military training. And again, as I said in my presentation, that it is not elective. You don't get the training simply because you're heading to Iraq or Afghanistan. You get the training because learning about religion and all the dynamics that surround it are important for everyone in the military. Even if you don't have to use it all the time, everywhere you go, it's important to know. Now, a lot of the training that is focused on cultural and religious aspects is directed towards civil affairs people, special units within the Army and the Marine Corps whose jobs are to advise commanding officers on such issues. There aren't enough of these people. There simply aren't enough. And we have chaplains who certainly understand the importance of religious dynamics in the lives of people and are certainly capable of advising commanding officers about the importance that religion can play. And many chaplains who have gone overseas have taken the time, their time, to learn about the religions in the area in which they are going to be operating, or their units are going to be operated. But again, there aren't enough chaplains.
Mm-hmm.
The Army has the largest chaplain corps in the world, and they do not have enough, and they are beating the bushes around this country trying to get people to join. The Navy has even fewer chaplains. We have to take care of the Marine Corps. We have fewer. There aren't enough to go around. So you have two groups of people who are fairly well trained
mm-hmm.
in these, although, frankly, all of us could be better trained.
Yes.
There aren't enough, which means that all military members need to get some education because they can't be assisted by civil affairs and chaplains all the time. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's going to get worse. As small units fight in remote areas everywhere, as Navy vessels go out, smaller Navy vessels that don't have chaplains, don't have access to civil affairs folks, it is going to become much tougher. Hence the need for more education.
Okay. Yes. Let's keep moving around the room. Let's start with the gentleman in the back. We've got quite a few hands here. I'm going to have to be a little selective based on my memory of who's had their hand up. This young woman here and the gentleman in the back. Let's have three of you together, and then you can respond.
My name is Dan Smith. I'm with Friends Committee of National Legislation. I'm also a retired Army Colonel of Vietnam War. Quick question to start out. What happened to the sheep?
What happened to
the sheep? To the sheep.
Oh, who had put the death threat on the colonel?
The lambs.
In your research, did you look at the training provided to U.S. military personnel who went over to Military Assistance Command Vietnam, MACV, in terms of culture, religion, as part of their training? My job was with Vietnamese, so that's a little different than a normal combat. Did you also look at training provided to Special Forces, which again are a separate branch of the military?
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, your comments about the ability of soldiers transition to non-combat roles. Did you examine and evaluate Daniel Kurlak's three-block war concept?
Okay, let's try to group
Got
questions
it.
Together. The young lady here.
I'm Annie King, with the Auditor Center also. And it seems like a lot of what you spoke of was kind of top-down tactics for implementing training of this nature. But it seems like it would also be necessary for a kind of grassroots movement from everyday people being more outspoken towards the government, saying the body count is not what we consider success. That's not what we consider a job well done in our military operations. But you also said that this isn't really things of kind of cultural and religious sensitivities and when those are successful, are not really sensational things in the news. They don't frequently make headlines. And so what methods might you propose for disseminating information through which the everyday people can become more aware of the importance that this holds?
Okay. And then finally in the corner.
This is Imam Muhammad Bashar Arafat. I would like to tell you that what you wrote about the issue of public diplomacy, that's extremely important, because I myself, last year, have done almost 9 countries with the public diplomacy program through the Office of Government Youth. And unfortunately, the things mostly taken from America to overseas, but very little is done in terms of public diplomacy here when it comes to the army or law enforcement in general. And also I'm the Muslim chaplain for the Baltimore City Police. And I go through that most of the time with the police here. I know that the talk was mainly about military, but I see also the need for the local law enforcement here in this country, which was not talked about too much, whether for the police or the FBI. So I just would like to reiterate the question here about the public diplomacy here and doing something with the military, or asking those who went and did a lot of programs about religious life in America to be transmitted to the military here.
Thank you. Let me address the questions about historical research in Vietnam first. One of the things that I have focused my time on was not so much the training that special forces received in that era, although I have looked at the training they receive now. And some of it can be extremely good. But again, of course, you're talking about a relatively small number. And in my opinion, it is still not enough because they are focused on a particular kind of mission. I would like to see more training given to them, but they are better trained than the average member of the military that is going through normal combat training. With regard to Vietnam, the focus of most of my research has been on the Strategic Hamlet program that went on early in the war, which proved to be, for which they had great hopes, but which proved to be a pretty dismal failure. And the program that came after General Kulak's program was basically shut down, which was called CORDS, which was run by, I think, John Paul Vann for a while, and which showed some measure of success, but which left out a large portion of the religion and cultural elements that had proved so successful in the Marine program. So that's what I focused on, as opposed to the one area in which you mentioned MacBee. That is not something with which I am familiar. If it's something I should be familiar with, I wish you would grab me afterwards and make me a little smarter, and I'll make sure and look at it. I believe the lambs were all eaten, male and female. They were all et up. With regard to public relations and publicizing things that go on within the military, if I understood you both correctly, and please correct me if I did not, what I think you're asking is, first, is there a way of making successful and unsuccessful efforts better known to the American public or within the military? That I need clarification on.
My question was kind of on just the American public, how to make it more of an issue at the forefront, things of cultural training, so that they can make the call, so that people can make the call to the government to say, this is important to us, do something about it. So it's not just from the top down being like, oh, well, this might be kind of important.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Very good question, and I'm not sure that I have a comprehensive answer for you, but because this is, frankly, a conversation that's just starting. There are only a few voices in the military and outside the military that are really focused on this at all. I mean, to a certain degree, chaplains within the military have been focused on it for over 200 years, but it has always been religion and religious training, religious sensitivity, religious acculturation, whatever you want to call it, has always been sort of pushed to the side. Mm-hmm. And to the degree that it was addressed, it was usually seen as something that the chaplain could take care of. You go and take care of a chaplain, don't bother me with it, is what a lot of commanding officers have said. There have been very few times when it has come to the fore. So it's just starting. So how to win the public relations campaign with regard to this? Frankly, that's something that I and others are still working out. You know, the tough part is just getting people within military leadership to listen at all, because they have so many other voices that are competing for, frankly, very few dollars and not enough time. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. My hope is that my project will push the conversation a little farther ahead. In the meantime, people like you, you can speak in the civilian world to what is needed and what is necessary. That's a wonderful way for you to contribute to the conversation. Truly it is. Yes, and did that answer your question, sir?
Well,
can we talk afterwards?
It's okay. A big topic. Yeah, we can talk afterwards. It's a little bit past 2. What I suggest is that we go until about 2:15. We won't have all questions responded to, but Dr. Hunter will be available after the talk. I thought at the other side of the table there was a question, and I wanted to make sure. Let me move on to this side of the table, and then we'll come back to you if there's time. Okay, so we'll have the three of you. And please remember to introduce yourselves to us.
Hi, my name's Jamila. I recently separated from the Navy.
Oh.
And I had the good fortune of going to Afghanistan, where I received no religious or cultural training, of course. And I worked in an intelligence field, and I took it upon myself to bring books about Islam and to educate other coworkers. So we're doing tremendous numbers of indiscretionary things related to the local population, and those are ignored, but that wasn't even the worst of it. Then within my command, like, numerous times I had to put in equal opportunity complaints because of things that were happening, like a chaplain saying, no, you're not allowed to use the chapel, it's for the Christians, there's more Christians than you. So then I made a 16-page policy change recommendation that I submitted that went nowhere. Submitted to congressmen, went nowhere. So my question to you is, like, there's looking out at the other cultures who we do things with on a combatant level and religious training, but what about the lack of tolerance for religious diversity within the troops and soldiers, Marines, sailors, that there's nothing to even protect Islamic faith? Like, there's things for Judaism, things for Christianity, but there's nothing to protect anything I believe. Like, even with regard to religious wear, accommodations, chapel time. I'm afforded no protection, but other faiths are. And I just want to know if you looked at what within the military they're doing currently, that if they're so closed-minded to not have acceptance for religious tolerance and diversity within the forces, if this could be a cause why they're not ready to accept religious training for combat situations going overseas.
Okay.
Charlotte, thank you for your talk, and I really appreciated your comments and analysis.
Introduce yourself first.
My name is Kamal Al-Hud. I work here at the Institute of Religion and Peacemaking. And I've, all of our conversations sort of came together, and I'm appreciating your challenges and the work you're doing and how to open up the minds and the curriculum of the military education. About 2 weeks ago, when I was came as an advisor to the Naval Academy to talk about the use of Islamic studies. And I think you and I have talked about how religious studies is not the same education you receive in Sunday school, but it is a real field of academic studies. The Academy of American Scholars of Religions, about 8,000 scholars. So I went on to talk about the academic and intellectual approach of studying religion, the theories of religion. Went on for 45 minutes in front of faculty and deans and so forth. The first question was, how do we know our midshipmen won't convert to Islam? And how do I know that our midshipmen won't start praying Islamically and won't and give up Christmas? And after, you know, I just thought, okay, the academies and the faculty have a strange perception of religion and religious studies. You know, no, forget about it, some of them are scientists, you know, you can't help them. But the others, you can help, right? That's one question, to really look into the curriculum, but to self-educate the scholars and teachers. The other question I have is a really hard question, and I think I think you know where I'm coming from, which is when General Boykin makes those comments, the notorious comments about my God, your God, and so forth, and you have sort of an exclusive interpretation of one's faith, at the end of the day, I think the perception on the ground in the Middle East or in elsewhere, our military folks are encountering another group of people in uniform. There's a question of power. There's a question of military power. The point that one encounters is through military means. And so even though with all this education sensitivity and blah, blah, you know, all that nice stuff, when the military meets the local foreign group, you're still meeting as military people. Mm-hmm. And how will you, you can't change that. So what do you do then?
Paul Wee is my name, Religion and Peacemaking, USIP. With my colleague, I totally agree. We resonate completely with the direction that you're going. Thank you very, very much. It's reminiscent, by the way, your main thesis of that that book that was published, I think it was back in the 60s, you know, before Kumar was born, the Ugly American. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a wonderful, wonderful book on being sensitive, because the hero, of course, is the ugly American, even though that expression has been sort of turned around these days. That is the hero. Be ugly, i.e., identify with the culture, be vulnerable. The word you used, very nice. Mm. My question has to do with the drama that was played out at the Air Force Academy last year involving Chaplain Melinda Morton. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I understand it, her protest was not against the fact that there was a lack of attention to religion, but precisely the opposite, that there was too much attention to a certain type of religious phenomenon in which troops were being, to use her word, indoctrinated, that was very, very harmful. And of course, I refer to what's sometimes called the Christian right. Falwell says Muhammad is a terrorist. Robertson says Islam is a demonic religion. Franklin Graham says that this is unmitigated evil in Islam. Her protest was against the fact that that type of understanding was being, through the commandant, and she named a number of other people, really indoctrinated not only the groups outside the fence, which were significant, but in the curriculum itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, if that situation has been corrected, is it widespread, and how you respond to it?
Okay. Thank you for all three questions. One, I'm sorry you're not in the Navy anymore. And I'm sorry that you had the experience you did and with the chaplain that you did. And I'm sorry, Kumar, that you met the reception you did from the faculty out there at the Naval Academy. I would have thought they'd be hiring much smarter people these days than apparently they are. How to deal basically with issues of religious discrimination touches upon the comments or questions of all three of you within American military ranks. It is a question with which all four of the chaplains who are here in the room have been wrestling for years. Collectively, we probably have about 100 years experience among the four of us. I would dare say that we spent a large portion of that time wrestling with just these issues. And they can be mighty tough because we walk a very fine line. And this is not to excuse anybody's stupidity or narrow-mindedness, but there is a fine line that has been established in which, on the one hand, I should be able to say whatever I want with regard to what I believe. On the other hand, I have to be willing to support your right to say whatever you want in terms of your religion, as long as, within the military, good order and discipline is maintained and the military mission is not harmed. It is not an easy task. However, one of the things that, in my own experience, I have found is that when there have been complaints, sadly this does not appear to have been the case when you were in Afghanistan, but when there have been complaints, that they have usually been addressed fairly well by most commanding officers. Not always well, but pretty well. And I put in that qualification for one reason, and that is because commanding officers in all four branches of the military receive wonderful educations in many, many fields. Religion is not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, when I have a religious issue, as a Christian Scientist, for example, I don't get immunizations. I have to go and talk about that to commanding officers when it is appropriate. And suddenly, this poor man or woman is suddenly faced with an issue that he or she had never even imagined existed. And now he's got to make a decision about it. Can I go forth into a combat area without my immunizations against certain diseases based on my religious faith? Does my religious freedom extend to that? Does he have the ability, does he have the authority to accommodate my religious needs? We don't train commanding officers particularly well in this area, quite apart from giving them an education in terms of comparative religions and the other dynamics that pertain to religion. Part of my project focuses on the fact that we do not put enough emphasis on teaching military leaders about how to accommodate religious practices, how to recognize those that are legitimate, which oftentimes means seeking out somebody else's expert opinion as opposed to simply relying on one's own prejudice. And we need to do a much better job on that. So I see the two as going hand in hand. Military leaders have got to be trained in religion and all its various dynamics, and they've got to be trained, specifically trained, in military rules and regulations with regard to religious accommodations, so that you do not run into a chaplain who says you can't use the chapel, because the chapel is open to anybody in the military, absolutely anybody, and so that you don't walk into a room of a group of people who say, well, by gosh, if we teach your faith here, are we going to lose some of our young men and women to that faith? They might be better off if they do. Hard to answer that. As for what's going on at the Air Force Academy, there have been a lot of corrective actions that have been taken over the last 2 years. They have not been highly publicized, although some heads have rolled, including, unfortunately, Melinda's, who she chose to get out as a result of that. And she was, you know, she was not very well experienced in the ways of the military. It was her first duty assignment. I think there is room to say that Melinda could have, Melinda Morton, Chaplain Morton probably could have handled the situation a little better. But that is also not to say that the military leaders there at the academy did not deserve the reprimands that they received. And the change in training that has gone on. But it has not settled down yet. When I leave here, I am going to a military organization, a Department of Defense organization called the Defense Equal Opportunity Management Institute. And one of the things that this organization, it's commonly called DOME, is working on right now is how to fix things at the Air Force Academy, because it has damaged the academy considerably. And we can't afford to allow that to continue. So they are getting a lot of training. Right now they're getting a lot of training from the Anti-Defamation League, and they'll get more.
Okay. Well, it's about quarter after. We're out of time, but again, Dr. Hunter will be available after the talk for questions. Thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking Dr. Hunter again for